I'll start by saying where I know Pat from. I was one of the fortunate people who was able to be one of the social assistance review researchers. And that's something, I'm sure everybody's heard about it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That was put together by Pat and two other of her colleagues. And that was done in Toronto. Also, too, I don't even know where to start. She is also a founding member of the Supportive House Coalition. This is all in Toronto. Gersten Crisis Center. And she's in the steering committee for the steering committee member for 25 and 5. And this is my favorite. She's a primary facilitator from Voices from the Street. Also, she has a blog on Toronto Star, the website, Your City, My City. That's Pat's. She's also an accomplished writer. One of the books is Upstairs at the Crazy Horse. Beyond the Crazy Horse, Dispatchers from the Poverty Line, Bound by Duty, and Walking with the Canadian Cops. Available at all fine bookstores. I could go on and tell you how much I think of her and how great I think she is, but that wouldn't really do her justice, and I don't want to take your time. So, my friend, Pat Capone.
Thank you, Nancy. Good to see you.
Thank you. You too, Pat.
Did we interview you in the Tim Hortons?
Sorry?
Yes, you were in a Tim Hortons, right?
Food bank.
Okay. We did most of the interviews in Tim Hortons. I got really tired of Tim Hortons. We had like 70 interviews for positions. Okay. I was saying before that I feel a bit conservative, but let me with this group over the last few days. What is that?
Recording device.
Okay. It's not kicking then. Okay, no. So I'm going to try and condense a lot. So if you have questions, write it down, and we'll have time after. But if I get derailed, it's like it takes me too long to catch up again. It's part of being crazy, I'm sure. Just to let you know that my career as a activist came out of being sent to a boarding home in the west end of Toronto that had 70 people in it, all from Whitby Site, Lakeshore Site, Queen Street, Mental Health Center. We were all kind of shoved into these buildings, no staff, for profit, and that was seen as good enough for chronic psychiatric patients. You became chronic if you kept going back to hospital because you didn't feel fixed. So they get tired of you, put on a chronic label. So that was my introduction to Toronto. I'm actually from Montreal, but on the main street in Toronto, 70 people in the most horrendous. It was really astonishing. My first book details that. But it was shocking, and I don't shock easy because I came out of a family where there was a lot of abuse and yuck stuff. But that really opened my eyes. Everybody in that place, well, a lot of them have died. I have mysteries now. I wrote two mysteries, and they're set in that building. And I've kind of resurrected some of the people that have died, and it's kind of like giving them a second chance to actually succeed at things and to enjoy life. So that's been kind of fun writing those mysteries. It's also another way of talking about poverty and showing poverty without doing this, right? Because nobody wants to read it when you're hectoring or when you're lecturing. I didn't know how that house came to be. I didn't know who was making decisions. It was a strange city. So I spent a few years going to City Hall, going to Queen's Park, trying to figure out who the hell did this? Whose bright idea was it to shove people in places like this, right? all the messages I was getting from nurses, psychiatrists, administration, politicians, was that the city said it's the province said it's the city, the hospital said it was the province said the hospital never listens to us. So it was like being a ping pong ball, nothing getting done. It seemed as though there was a belief that chronic psychiatric patients were incapable of insight, incapable of moving forward. The only thing that we could do was take medication, which was really brutal. It was the old antipsychotic medication, and that was the only thing we had in abundance in this building. There were no community agencies. Like, you guys have a blue book, you know, list of social services. We have one in Toronto that's about yay thick. Nobody was coming in. Nobody was coming in, which taught me when you're at the bottom, people let you fall. People let you fall. So I started bringing in newspapers, started bringing in politicians and exposing conditions of these boarding homes, and that was my beginning. Skip ahead. My publisher was Ping in Canada, and they sent me across Canada to look at Inner City Park, which was kind of interesting. It was kind of a busman's holiday, except I got really good hotels, and like they pay for the hotels, and they pay for the plane, and they give you a keeper who drives you around. It was all very cool. And then to discuss poverty. So, there are hotels where I was afraid to leave my fingerprints because it was all sort of very shiny. But by the time I got from Vancouver to St. John's, in St. John's, a woman running an agency who looked like she'd stepped out of Vogue magazine, telling me how wonderful she was doing. At that point, I thought, if one more person tells me how great their agency is, I'm going to kill somebody, because everybody was saying how great their agencies were. People weren't doing great. People were doing kind of really bad. I had worked in my neighborhood, Parkdale, for 7 years in a drop-in. I have been away for a while. I go back. Staff have paid off their mortgages, sent their kids to school, paid off their cars. The members, many of whom have died because, of course, if you're poor, that's what happens. And these are the poor of the poor. So the food is, like, really bad. So people get all the usual diseases. I was a keynote at the Association of health centers, physical health centers, that's not what they call themselves, but community health centers. And I was there, they said they wanted to fight chronic disease. If you want to fight chronic disease, you have to fight poverty. If you don't fight poverty, that's what. And the next year, I had a massive heart attack and a quadruple bypass. I went back and said, see, I told you. I really got to work on this. But our guys were dying and are dying. There's like a memorial service a week. So it's a pretty urgent situation, and I've been a staff. I've also been part of creating agencies, some of which I'm proud of and some of which I cringe about. Now I'm a part of an organization called Ontario Council of Alternative Businesses, which is businesses that are run totally by sex survivors. I started to realize, I guess when I was hitting St. John's, that the simply poor, you forgive the term, I don't know how to, the poor that weren't crazy, the simply poor, I called them at the time, exhibited a lot of the symptoms. If I had a group of poor people, I would say, tell me how it feels. Tell me how you feel. And they'd say they're depressed, they're isolated, they're ashamed, they're stigmatized, they're bored, and many other, poverty mimics mental illness, because when we were in our traps, our boarding houses and rooming houses, we were depressed. We were bored. We were isolated. But we blamed the mental illness. So did the staff. So did the doctors. We're all in these silos. We're all kept apart, right? So if you're crazy, you go there. If you have physical challenges, you go there. If you're a single parent, you go there. We don't talk to each other as a rule. We don't communicate. And certainly the effect of that is everybody's using a really narrow lens. Poverty doesn't ever become the issue. No. If you're having a hard time, it's that mental illness that you got. So let me give you more medication. We'll take care of it. I came to this realization very slowly because I was jingoistic about my category of mental illness, you know, that the most poor, the most defeated, you know what, the most active. As a community, we started to push. We had an underground paper we put out, and we were pretty smart about that. You could only afford a couple of hundred. This was way before computers. God, some of you guys probably weren't born then. How depressing. we would put it out, but make sure that copies got to the Minister of Health, that copies got to the Deputy Minister. So they, of course, would think, oh, my God, this must be all over the place. We also mailed it to the Globe and Mail and the Toronto Star. So we started getting all these articles, you know, and then you get invited to things like the second meeting of the Supportive Housing Coalition, which started the supportive housing for psychiatric survivors. They never took us from Parkdale, though. They never opened one in Parkdale. They never had one in Parkdale. That was because they didn't want to upset the neighbors, because our guys couldn't hide the fact that they're crazy because of the poverty, right? And so they had like level one, level two, level three, level four. That was the kinds of supports. So when we pushed and pushed and said you have to have one in Parkdale, they called it level zero. The Supportive Housing Coalition is one of the cringeworthy things that I started to get kind of annoyed that agencies were picking and choosing who they would deal with. But I also remember being a staff of the drop-in, how many times I would, feeling okay about it, but escort someone to the door for being noisy, scary, armed, stoned. And you know, you just take someone to the door and close the door after them. And it occurred to me when I was in St. John's, how many agencies are doing that? How many staff are taking people to the door and closing it and locking it after them? And what happens to those guys that we lock out? Those guys that whose behaviors are bad, happens to them? Well, they become second and third and fourth generation welfare families, don't they? They fill the jails. If there's, especially in times like now, if there's a lot of middle class who are dropping into poverty, agencies very much prefer to work with people who are polite, nice, thankful, smile, aren't challenging. Right? We like those guys. We don't like the anger. Oh, anger is bad. You know? When I was doing leadership facilitation across this province for the Ministry of Health, I looked for guys that were angry, because that meant there were signs of life. Mm-hmm. And anger, as long as it doesn't consume you, can be used to fuel you. You know, get you going, get you moving, get you working towards change. Anger is really important and shouldn't be medicated away. When we started these businesses, when we started achieving, when I remember the head of one agency wrote her PhD thesis saying, where did all these talented people come from? Why could we never see them before? And they never saw us. They never saw us as people with potential. We were walking, talking diseases that needed to be medicated, that needed to be shoved away, kept out of sight. And the drop-ins that were created for psychiatric survivors were like hospices, just places to while away time till you die. which, as I said, didn't take too long. So it became like really offensive, an offense to me. I'm glad that that's real music. And we tried to, in the early days, we tried to have alliances, but people were very, very angry. The staff of the hospitals were very angry. The staff of community agencies were angry at the suggestion that they weren't being, that they weren't helping. Canadian Mental Health Association lost the letter I wrote conveniently for about 4 years, saying, you know, the letter said politely, "Where the hell are you? Come, you know, we have a psychiatric ghetto here. The newspapers say it. There's like 1,200 people within four blocks. Where the hell are you?" But they lost the letter, gave me an award, which was nice, but. So I started to become a little suspicious how things are. But I think it was one day I was talking to hospital staff. And I kind of realized that you don't change people by confronting them. You don't win hearts and minds or change people's behavior by yelling at them. That there had to be another way to engage with people to make change, because that's our job. That's our job. If you're an activist, your job is to change things. Your job is to improve conditions. You rarely do that with a stick of dynamite. I mean, there's times, but it's rare. So I had to start figuring out, what does it feel like to be a staff? Well, I knew what it was like to be a staff. I knew some of the challenges there. I talk to young social workers who get all starry-eyed and dewy-eyed, and they just, "Oh, I love the people I'm working with. Ooh, you can't do that." I never understood when I was working with people, I never understood that I was cutting the legs out from people by doing four, by always intervening, by not allowing people to find their own self-control, find their own motivations. You know, I was always there, which makes a good staff. Eh? So I do these groups called Voices from the Street. And where do we get the money for this? Well, this is really weird. We went to the Atkinson Foundation, which used to own the Toronto Star. Not people that you would think would be overly friendly. And we said, we want to run a 12-week program for people on who've been homeless, who have problems with addictions, who have physical challenges, single moms, newcomers. We want to run this program. We want to pay people to attend. $60 a week, 3 days a week, 10 to 4. Psychiatric survivors never get up early in the morning because they have a whole lot of medication that they have to take. So we always start at 10. If you want to call a meeting, never call a meeting. Because the medication is really, really bad, and it makes people very tired. We started out, actually, with a group paid by the city, with a group that were just survivors. And that became way too insular, because we've been taught, as crazy folks, we've been taught to keep our noses and our navels and not to see outside. Everything is seen just through our own pain, our own diagnosis. So if I would leave the room, there would be fights, there would be behavioral problems, there would be people screaming, "What the hell is this? We're grown-ups. We're supposed to be grown-ups." We started adding people with addictions. People with addictions usually have had a life, whereas people with mental illness have been locked up for most of theirs. So the people with addictions said to the people with mental illness, "Why do you let yourself be talked to the way staff talk to you?" And the people with the mental illness said, "Oh yeah, why do we let people talk to us like this? Why do we let them treat us like we're children?" Then tell you about this group, Nancy's group. I don't like food banks, but I was approached by the Daily Bread Food Bank, the research department there, to partner with Voices from the Street to bring 20 people together. Do a Voices leadership facilitation. I'll tell you how that works in a sec. And then the people from the research department were going to teach them skills in terms of interviewing. First, surfacing questions that they would like to ask people on welfare and ODSP. And that was a long process, getting the questions together. And then we gave people video cameras. I still don't know how to use the one knife, but that actually download and do all this kind of stuff. And we've been swamped with these videos, which are quite amazing, with people all different walks of life, because there's many pathways into poverty, who are being really honest about the barriers and being really honest about what they want, what they need. And mostly people want to work. They want to get the hell off ODSP. They want to get the hell off welfare, because we're smart enough to know that what the government gives with one hand, the government takes away with the other. We'll always be vulnerable to Mike Harris lookalikes to have clawback. When we bring people together, I stumbled upon this, really. They have to introduce themselves by talking to one of three questions. The first time I ran out of food. The first time I couldn't pay my rent. The first time I found myself out on the street. They have to speak for 5 to 7 minutes on one of those. Now remember that most of us never get to meet as clients, as users, as, I hate that word user, the provider, the user. That sets up a really interesting power dynamic, doesn't it? It just, I'm down here, you're there. That's not good. We've got to fix that. We don't get to meet by ourselves. We don't have much respect for each other as people with lived experience. We don't want to identify ourselves, because there's a lot of shame, a lot of stigma. We really don't want to do that. We look up to staff. That's what we're supposed to do. But unfortunately, we can't be them because we haven't had, as a rule, middle-class backgrounds. Our values are different. Our experiences are so radically different now that poverty is so deep and so consuming. Poverty now is not the poverty I first experienced as a kid. That's not there. And too many people think poverty is what they experience when they're in university, but they're moving through it, whereas people are stuck, and they know they're stuck. They know there's no happy tomorrow. So we're trying to change that dynamic. So when people come in to Voices from the Street, it's set in OCAB, Ontario Coalition of Alternative Businesses. Everybody on that floor is crazy. Everybody. So everybody has been poor, everybody's been powerless, but everybody's working. Some people actually buy houses, drive cars. Like, it's kind of astonishing to me. I'm an old man, crazy. So it sets a different dynamic. It says achieving. So as the guys walk in and they sit down and they don't know what to expect and they're nervous, they have to meet, and there's no passing, there's no saying, oh, I can't do that, oh, I'm too tense, oh, I don't want to do that. Everybody has to do it, and they do. They stand up one at a time and they tell those stories. They tell those stories. It is the most powerful, and it reorients, it just almost immediately reorients people from the shame to saying, you know, I can't respect myself. I don't feel like a strong person. But, oh, my God, what you've been through, what you survived, what did it take for you to be here today? How did you make it out? How did you You know, so people start to see each other in a whole different light. And if I see you in a different light, you're like me. So maybe I can feel better about who I am. Maybe I can feel better about my experiences. And people talk, you know, on the most intimate level, without a lot of tears, without a lot of shaking, without hysteria, without... They talk as adults. That's another thing that's missing in our world, is we don't put expectations on people. It's like when our friends say, raise the welfare rates. Well, Jesus, give us a job. Give us something. You know, don't keep us on subsistence. This is not a heavy goal. A goal is to have enough money to live decently, to not be afraid all the time, to not be hypervigilant and worry about the landlord coming. You know, let's raise the standards of our requests here, right? It just astonishes me that's what we're asking for. We should be asking for a lot more. So that first day, people know there's something different going on here. We tell people we don't expect you to be cured, and we don't expect you to stop using drugs if you're using drugs. We don't expect you not to party. However, if you're going to get paid, you come to work ready to work. So you can't come hungover, you can't come stoned. You come straight, right? Or gay, doesn't matter. But you know, you get there. And you're ready to do the work. And the work is intense. I get the guys for the first 6 days. They only have me there. Poor buggers. And my goal is to form them into a strong and powerful group that cares about each other, that's starting to grow, that understands they are the experts in their own lives. Because that is not the message that they've been getting. Okay? So how do they get to know that they're the experts? Well, with this group, with Nancy's group, I stumbled on something that was really useful. So take all the guys that were, their main issue is addictions, put them at one table and get them to teach everyone else in the room about what the barriers are, what it's like, you know, to be crack addicted or coke addicted or heroin addicted. What's it like to have to prostitute yourself? What's it like, you know, so people talk about that. We brought together the newcomers. One woman, Seema, came from Iran, got off the plane, asked for a refugee status, put in handcuffs, screamed at, taken to detention. She was insulted, the country was insulted, and she's the most very tiny, very frail looking woman. For the guys that were crazy in the group, the guys with mental illness in the group, this was the first time they'd heard about this kind of thing, that our country does this to people. And it kind of jolted them out of that little silo, that mental health silo, where all you think about is how you're feeling or your symptoms or the meds that we've got to take, right? Then we had a woman from Thunder Bay, Joanne, who's has MS. She's in an electric wheelchair. She's legally blind, hearing difficulties, and has epilepsy. She had a job at the university there. She earned more when she didn't work than she got from ODSP when she did work because of the clawbacks. She's very articulate about that and wrote an op-ed for the Star about that. She talked about what it's like to not get out all winter because you don't have the sidewalks aren't properly cleaned. You can't go out in your wheelchair because the snow is too deep. So she spends almost all winter in bed. And how is that making her feel better? How is that engaging her? She can't get places because, of course, money for the wheel trans isn't there. When the guys came together, the first day, we had senior policy people from the Ministry of Health, from Comms, Community and Social Services, and from Laura Broughton's ministry, which is the children stuff, but she's also the poverty minister. We had those senior policy people there to greet them, to let them know that they were going to monitor the process, that they had respect, that they didn't have to, our guys didn't have to throw stones. They had access to those ministries. And we have that access because for the last 3 or 4 years, every group has a very public graduation at City Hall, and ministers sometimes come and thank the guys for their, you know, like that. And we tend to meet with the ministers in their boardrooms, and the guys are trained in engagement and trained in advocacy and how to be hearts and minds. That's what we do. It's a very incredible experience to, it's a humbling and a bit scary sometimes to watch these guys energize. It's to throw off. See, God, I just felt like George Bush for a minute there. John Stewart doing George Bush. when you go, and this again, this, I've been taught over the last, I think this is the fifth group that we've done, but it's when you're agency dependent, when you spend your days going from agency to agency, from food bank to hospitals to wherever the hell, you lose heart. You really lose heart. You lose your voice. Realistic or not, reality-based or not, you fear that if you speak out, your worker won't like you anymore. You might lose your housing. Or one of those nice staff will take you to the door because maybe you're too angry and close the door after you. People that show up are broken. They are broken and beaten. And you can feel the depression in the room. You can feel it. Until that first person stands up and starts talking. And then there's a sense, this is something new. This is something new. After the first 6 days, 2 weeks, we start bringing in outsiders. Explain to people, you are experts in yourselves, and you learn from each other. Now it's time to learn from friendly professionals. So John Stapleton, some of you guys might know John. Some of you guys met. It's like having an insider tell you, he spent 28 years in the Ministry of Social Services. So, and he's on our side. So we learn all kinds of shit from him, and it's very cool. I bring in now Deputy Chief Mike Federico to talk about a policing issue. And the guy's funded a little mic, remember? I don't know if I could take this. We bring in media experts to talk about how to deal with media. We bring in people to explain what kind of advocacy is going on across the city. People are asked to choose their passion. Choose their passion. What do they want to be? What do they want to strengthen? Children's aid is a big thing with this group. Children's aid is huge. For some, it's children's aid. For some, it's work. For some, I'm trying to remember here. I do have notes. Harm reduction. What we found with this group and with the videos that they sent in and with the applications that we got from around the province is people want to work in the helping professions because that's what they know, right? People want to be, they want to work in harm reduction, they want to be social workers, they want to be community workers, they want to do it right. They want to do it right. There's a lot of resistance to this because we've over-professionalized, we've over-credentialized caring. We've made it so technical. We've put all these big words around it. And we've ensured that we don't really get there. With all the professionals. When I was at the drop-in, I was one of five staff and the only crazy there. And I had to kind of interpret between the staff and the drop-in members, and then from the drop-in members to the staff. So it was like very confusing. It became very clear to me after a while that we need to integrate staff. We need to have an integrated staff. We need to have workers with credentials, formal credentials, and we need to have workers who have life experience. Life experience by and of itself is not enough. It's how you've borne your challenges. Because it can make you bitter, it can make you so enraged that you can't function, or it can make you empathetic, it can make you learning to change things, you know, and it can make you caring. So we started pushing for hiring. So like at the Gerstein Center, which is a non-medical model crisis center for people in all these words, like psychosocial crisis. So it's, you know, 10 beds, a van, 24-hour phone line. We got this through partnering with Dr. Eva Gerstein, who's 93, and I still talk to her most every week. Great lady. First person to listen to us as survivors. She got us this center. And she allowed me to say, all else being equal, if you're crazy, you get a job. Of course, we found out all else isn't ever equal because our guys have been locked up so long. So we also have two apprenticeship programs for a year, really well paid, for a crazy and a multicultural, who hopefully is also crazy, for a year, given all the crisis training, and then put in other agencies, or actually sometimes like at the university, but to be change agents, those are the goal. We are pushing work in the system because we have to change the system, and you can't change it from the outside. I trained crazies to be on boards. That was the first thing that I was doing. Boards of directors, you got to crash those boards. In terms of voices, I heard there was, you always got to go where they don't want you to go. You always got to go where you know you're not going to be welcome. I intercepted this email, which was probably sent to somebody else, and it talked about this new organization, 25 and 5, which was having its second or third meeting. And I looked, and it was all agency people. I thought, screw this. So I wrote a heavy email, you know, nothing about us without us kind of thing. And I went there and did the mau-mau at the table, guilted them, and have been there ever since. This has given us more resources because agencies have captured all the resources. When you talk about not having a place to meet, we don't, as people directly affected, we don't get those resources. We have to take them back. We have to take them back, at least part. I remember years ago, I think it was here in Kingston, coming here years ago, and there was a survivor draw, an ex-mental patient drop-in, we weren't survivors yet, and staff had, it was like a church, and the staff desks were all on the second floor, and the file, big file cabinet, and downstairs were all the flesh, right, all the users. They weren't allowed to put their feet on the stairs going up, and it was great. I used that as an example for years of that false hierarchy. You know, we couldn't even put a foot on a step. What the hell is that? We have more rights in the institution than we have in the community. It's scary. idea is to change things, you've got to engage. And when you engage, that means you have to know how to speak and to people who don't want to hear you. It's very weird how angry people can get. There's a big agency in Toronto. I was sitting opposite this guy on 25 and 5, and I haven't been yelled at for years, because for some reason people are scared of yelling at me. Because you nuke them as soon as they yell at you. It's a rule. And this jerk, who has a very, very large agency, started talking for people with lived experience. And I said, excuse me, you can't do that. And he said, what do you mean I can't do that? Of course I can do that. I said, no, you can't. I mean, this guy comes out of privilege. He's making his salary and his reputation on our backs, truly. He said, well, who am I supposed to speak for? And I said, well, you could speak for executive directors. He was mortally offended. And I didn't particularly care at that point. But he started shouting at me through the hallway, into the elevator, down to the elevator, up to the street. He's still shouting at me. Why don't you like me? Your friend likes me. Like, it was like, Jesus. And if somebody doesn't get that basic thing, how the hell can you deal with them? No, you can't. And I was just so shocked that I was being bullied. So I just kept saying, fuck off. Go. So we get out in the street, and there's my coordinator, Mike Creek. You may have read, we just bought a condo. It is so cool. He went from Toronto Community Housing to a condo. He was in group number 3. He's quite a remarkable young fella. He's lost the whole person in terms of weight. He's feeling really good about himself. He's breathing down my neck. I feel that. He's a lovely guy, lovely guy. He had cancer, got flung into poverty. He's in Toronto Community Housing, one of those large towers. He said, I looked up and 14 years had gone. 14 years had gone. He said, fighting cancer was easy compared to fighting poverty. Now he's got this beautiful new condo. Very nice. It's very good to see. Very neat to see. And he did a really good piece of stuff. There are people who understand what we're trying to do, and some of those guys are in really good political positions in the industry. Dan Matthews in health, Laurel Broughton, both. They say. Agencies will always ask for more money. We want to hear directly from the people. Well, we bring the people directly to them so that they hear them. It is so cool to take a graduating class, to sit in the minister's boardroom, the minister having to sit there, and everybody getting a chance to say what they need to say. And I don't censor what they say because they already know hearts and minds, and they know how to reach, how to talk. So they've been very, very powerful in winning over some quite powerful politicians, which is really nice. We still have a lot of work to do on that basis, of course. All these videos that we have, which are remarkable, one of the most remarkable, there's a lady, she's about 3 feet tall. She's got a disease that one in 400,000 lifers get. Something to do with your bones and your lungs, right? And she's all kind of crowded onto this little contraption that she uses. And on the video, she says, I'm afraid I can only work 3 hours a day. And I said to myself, if I had the challenges this lady had, I'd be crawling under my bed and I'd never surface. But that's the kind of guts people have, and that's the kind of yearning people have to make a difference. You know, I noticed that people have gone through 100 courses. You know, everybody's taking courses. George Brown in Toronto is like benefiting hugely. But taking all these courses, doing well at these courses, and then being turned away from the jobs that you're training for, which is really shitty. And part of that is because of lived experience. But don't lose hope. My kid sister, Diana, not a kid anymore, was a heroin addict, had a really difficult time in life, became an advocate, and CAMH, Center for Addiction and Mental Health, hired her because of her name and because of her advocacy. She now works in the human resources department, and her job is to ensure that we get fair break at jobs in that hospital system. It's a hell of a job. It's a hell of a task, but that's what she does, which is very good. I know how capable people are, and I know that that capability is stolen from them in the system as it is now. The SARAC report, you may have heard, I was on that with John Stapleton and Mike Mendelson, all these guys, you know, appointed to ComSoc to look at a review of welfare and ESP. And what we said is, you've got to blow it up. You just got to blow it up, right? It is so bad. It is so stigmatized. We just have to redo. And we recommended like an 8-month process with two commissioners and using the group that Nancy's a part of or a group like it to ensure that people's voices and direct experience is heard. And they seem to have agreed to that. We will see. It's hard to trust some people. The same is with universities. Universities are the ones that produce the social workers, produce the people who staff agencies like Children's Aid, like hospitals. It's not working. There is something in the dynamic of client staff that is unhealthy, that is that maintains a power differential that cripples people, that allows people. You notice there's an amazing lack of urgency in most agencies dealing with the poor. There's no sense of, we got to do this, you know. People close their door at 5, whether or not people have any place to go. We get used to these things. As staff, we get used to these things. So that's why, as people with experience, we need to be on staff to remind people that these are valuable lives that are wasted, that are coming. And we have to re-inject that sense of urgency. We have to say, all these things were set up, all these agencies, all these helpers, all these learnings that people go through at university were set up without benefit of hearing from us. And because of that, it's a lot of wrong-footedness up there. The simple wrong-footedness. And people should not be allowed to pick and choose who they're going to work with, who they're going to deal with. It's wrong. It's just wrong. Whenever they can't work with someone, it's because you're hard to house, you're hard to serve. No. You just don't know how to do it yet. It doesn't mean, it's like you can't blame the victim here. You've got to spend time. You've got to spend equal time with this. I engage so much with folks. We were approached by a baby psychiatrist from the University of Toronto, the last bastion of power out there, right? Two very charming baby psychiatrists. They were in their first year, and they said, can we start meeting? Because I think we need to develop an underground curriculum. Because clearly what you're saying, we don't find it in our courses. And we've been meeting now 3 years. And you know what? We meet in each other's houses. And that is so amazing. Those of you who have a psychiatrist may know this. Like, we don't discuss our personal illnesses or anything like that. We discuss issues, right? As adults. And it's fun. And you know what? At the President's Forum of the Canadian Psychiatric Association about a month ago, we showed how we do that. We were the main presenters. We were on the stage. It's called RACI, Residents and Consumer Initiative, and we played out a meeting like that, and they loved us. It's change. You can actually see and feel and hear, you know, which is really cool. That we may actually have some good psychiatrists out there who will hesitate before using shock treatment, who will hesitate before assigning someone to assertive community treatment, God help them, and who understands that not all medication is wonderful. We find now that when people have started to move, they want work. They want to keep going forward. They want to keep moving forward. And that block that's there, we have to work to ensure that, for instance, I was called by United Way because they were changing their, what's-her-name was retiring, and they were hiring a new one, so they do this call around. What do you think should be done? We're going to be pressing them to do what the Ministry of Health did for us as crazy folks, which is no grants unless you can show that you're moving people out of poverty and that you're hiring from the population your target group. Right? So those two things. They got to put a catch on to those two things. Right? You want our money? Show us. The Ministry of Health did this under the NDP and the Liberals last time around, making it a funding requirement that we had to be on their board. They were asked, do you have, they didn't say crazies, but you know, do you have crazies on staff? If not, what are your plans? So, you know, you just keep pushing, and don't let them off the hook, right? If you stand outside the system, which is valid, I suppose, you like to stand outside and throw, and it feels good to do that. Oh, it feels so pure and righteous. Oh, I remember there was something called the Ontario Advocacy Commission years ago, just before Harris, and we spent months getting ready and hiring from all the various disability groups and vulnerable groups. We had the most diverse staff that you'd ever want to, and then of course he shut us down. Quite dramatically, just shut us down. So I went from being a commissioner to being so broke that I was hallucinating my landlord coming to the door. That's when I figured out that poverty is worse than mental illness, actually. Because I wasn't crazy, but I was, like, really. I got a good book out of it, though, Dispatches from the Poverty Line. Very good. But you can stay outside, you can stay really angry, and you will not be affected. I ask the guys that work with us, don't be a 24/7 activist. You'll dry up. Step outside your area of comfort. Step outside your neighborhoods. Meet people that I'm going to be meeting next week. I'm meeting with a guy who wants to talk about microloans to female survivors, psychiatric survivors. And he has the money to do that. I'm going to meet with him. He's going to be my best friend. You know, I'm going to cultivate him. That's what they call it. The cops I meet with, I'll do a dance. Because it's my job. I'm a leader. You can't be a leader if you don't have anybody following. But you've got to be a leader, and a leader has to do it first. They have to break through. They have to. You know. So I will smile at the cops as long as there is a payoff in this. There has to be a payoff. There has to be a steady move forward. Okay? Who else can we do? But the shrinks were amazing. The cops, G20 was a huge setback. And the weirdest thing is that we have never had such a liberal police board and never had such a liberal chief. And it's just astonishing that this would happen again. It's mind-boggling. makes you really scared because we might get bored, and oh my God. The public themselves, oh yeah, and hit the media up. Hit the media up. Don't, you know, talk about media like they're another animal, but look at the papers, find reporters who are reasonable. Bring them into your communities. Don't ever lie, don't ever exaggerate, we don't have to, right? Just show them the kinds of stuff that you want to show them. Bring them in. We have some wonderful reporters who are always there, that when we need them. And it can be television, it can be newspapers. Our guys, Nancy, remember when those op-eds started to appear, done by our guys? Our guys, doing op-eds and talking about their lives, pretty spectacular. And that's just the beginning. The big thing now is going to be social enterprise. So if you're dealing with dispossessed youth, if you're dealing, the problem is poverty. That is the problem. Whatever the other little diagnosis, the main problem is poverty. Deal with poverty. I asked the crazy guys in the housing program, if you had to choose between a middle-class life, middle-class salary, but being crazy, or being poor and normal, what would you choose? And they all laughed and said, you know, we already know what it's like to be crazy. Bring the money on. Bring the money on. It's very interesting in terms of the impact of mental illness. We talk about for women who've been abused, the guys who've been abused, and that goes for that. You don't have to be crazy to go through that. But the impact of that is like a black hole of need, of want, of it takes over your life, you know. But if you start to get a life, if you start to be active, if you start to fight, it reduces that size of that black hole dramatically. It reduces the impact of that on your life because you feel that you are able to affect, you're able to protect people that are coming after you, you know. You're able to make a difference, and that feels really good. When the guys come out of the minister's boardroom, they're practically skipping because they have seen the face of authority, and that face was listening to them and respectful of them and of their input. That's very important. It's probably the best way to cure whatever ails you is to get some perspective and to go out and to fight for change. You will drive people away if all you do is sit together and meet and bitch. You will drive people. Who's going to come back for that? You know? So make sure that you have social time, and that doesn't mean like a drop-in, but it means getting to know each other first. Okay? Get to know each other because it's an easier way to break down those barriers. Get to know each other. Be kind to each other. Choose your spots. Don't talk all the time. When you're at meetings, make sure that you're able to draw other people out. That's really important, to get other people speaking, because we've all been silenced. Okay, I'm going to take questions or comments.
You can do that if you want.